I'm Jackie Brolsma, and I have worked in the field of chemical dependency for about the last 12 years in a variety of settings, counseling families as well as individuals, and that's my own professional background. I want to ask, first of all, if there's anybody in here who's somewhat familiar with the term codependency. Yeah, a real obvious definition when you just look at the word would mean to be a partner in dependency, right? To be a partner in the process of dependency. And that's really close, but it still leaves the word a little bit unclear. And there are many definitions of this phenomena, I have to say. And it's somewhat of a fairly recent development. It really was not a term that started to even be used. It's not even in the dictionary. It's not even in the dictionary of alcoholism terms yet. And it's a word that started appearing really only in the late 70s. And it's come really out of a growing awareness of the problems that are associated with being raised in a family in which there is a history of chemical dependency or other kinds of addictive behaviors. It's kind of a dysfunctional way of living and of viewing life that has often resulted from the prolonged exposure to an addictive disease process. It affects people not only emotionally or mentally, but also physically and spiritually, which is significant. And it comes out of the awareness, too, that chemical dependency touches the whole family, and that, in effect, spouses and children and friends and relatives become codependent, in a sense, or in another kind of way, what they get addicted to, unlike the chemically dependent person gets addicted to the chemical, they really get addicted to the dysfunctional alcoholic family system. They get addicted to the whole pattern of kind of relating. And in many ways, some people sometimes describe it as being addicted to a relationship or addicted to somebody. It's when we expand it, you know, at first we started to look at just maybe wives, or because for many years we thought only men had alcoholism. We would talk about it as being a pattern you saw in the wives of alcoholics. Well, as we've become to, you know, more sophisticated in treatment and also in knowing and understanding alcoholism, we've started to see it and identify it in other kinds of problems. You see it often in over and under eating problems, gambling, certain sexual behaviors. You see the phenomena of codependency. And with increased kind of understanding of this whole phenomena, we've been led to really see it in certain groups of people. We see it in adult children of alcoholics. We see it in people who have relationships with either emotionally or mentally disturbed people. We see the phenomena in people who have relationships with chronically ill people. We see it in parents of children with behavior problems. And we see it in professionals, such as nurses, social workers, pastors, and others who are often labeled helping professions. And when a codependent person seems to end their relationship with one troubled person, what we see frequently happen is they seek another and repeat it, another kind of relationship and repeat many of the same behaviors, which is why we began to investigate it more and be real curious about the whole process. Well, then we began to ask the question, well, is it safe to assume that it's triggered by having relationships with people who have these serious illnesses? Is that, you know, what pushes the button, is getting involved with troubled kinds of people or behavior problems or destructive compulsive disorders? Although that's a common denominator, what seems to be an even more common denominator is that oftentimes these people have come from families which had unwritten, silent kind of rules that usually develop in the immediate family and then set the pace for what the relationships are to be like. What those rules are, I have them here. Some of those rules that you see happening in families that are either high stress is you don't talk about the problem. We don't air our dirty laundry in public. Some of these I talked about more yesterday.
And if we have to admit to having problems, then we're not okay and we're weak and we're unhealthy. So oftentimes people who have trouble with codependency come from families that might have a rule like that. Or don't express your feelings. And that prohibits us from knowing who we are and assists kind of in the denial process. Don't let your feelings come out. A third kind of rule is communication is indirect. I talked about that a little bit yesterday, the triangle that people get caught up in, with one person usually acting as the messenger between two other people. That victimizes people and avoids honesty, and it's powerful for the person who gets caught in the middle. So communication is indirect. Another rule that we see people having in families that struggle with codependency is unrealistic expectations, like be strong, be good, be right, be perfect. Make us proud all the time in everything that you do. Pretty strong and unrealistic expectations. A fifth one is don't be selfish. Don't think of yourself. This produces a lot of guilt, which is sometimes, I think, a common Lutheran one or Catholic. Always thinking of others. Try to feel good about ourselves by always giving to others. That's where a lot of our self-worth comes, is helping, helping, helping. And that keeps us stuck often in unfulfilling relationships, and it also feeds our low self-esteem. So be selfish, or don't be selfish, rather, is a common rule. A sixth one is do as I say, not as I do. Don't trust others. Distrusting one another in the family keeps us guessing what others might want us to do. So there's often that message of do as I say, not as I do. Another family rule that kind of breeds codependency is it's not okay to play. It's not okay to be playful. Work is very important. These rules mean that family members have to work twice as hard to feel okay about themselves. Real strong work ethic. Work is more important than playing or having fun and feel boring, unsure of themselves. Often work helps define the roles and boundaries. It's like you know your role in the family by the kind of work that you do. And it kind of gives the illusion of security. We're secure if we have all the work done. In my own family, that was a real strong rule. You know, you weren't allowed to work or play until all of the chores were done, all of the work was done. And many people, when they die, you know, talk about they just wish they would have picked more daisies or how the poem goes. So that's a common rule. And then the last one is don't rock the boat. Change is not okay. You know, everybody stay rigid and in their exact position. Don't question. And those are all kind of the rules that become a part of the daily life of families where codependency might be bred. I don't know, some of you might feel free to add any other kinds of rules that you experienced as well or are familiar with that are also a part of that kind of family dynamic that I'm talking about. Anybody have any other ones that they want to add? So then we ask the question, well, what is codependency? And which is an accurate way to really look at it? I'll give you some light examples of it, maybe to begin with. Sometimes people define codependency as the feeling of laying on your deathbed and seeing somebody else's life pass before you. That's what codependency is. Is because you've spent your whole life obsessing on somebody else that when you die, you know, it's really somebody else's life who passes before you. A simple way, really, of maybe defining codependency is saying that a codependent person is one who lets another person's behavior affect him or her and who is obsessed with controlling that person's behavior. A codependent is one who has let another person's behavior affect him or her and who is obsessed with controlling that person's behavior. And the important part of the definition a lot of people might say that, well, who's the other person? Now, the other person might be a friend, it might be a family member, it might be a relative, it might be a coworker, it might be somebody who's mentally ill, it might be a client, it might be a boss, it might be anybody, really, who you get obsessed with in the sense of trying to control them. The heart of the definition, though, doesn't lie in who the other person is. The heart of the definition lies more in ourselves. Because no matter how much we believe, you know, it's the other person who should change, it lies in ourselves and in the way we try to affect them. The way that we try to change them. The obsessing, the controlling, the helping, the caretaking, the low self-worth that borders on self-hatred, the self-repression, and the abundance of anger and guilt, the peculiar dependencies on peculiar people, attraction to intolerance for the bizarre, being willing to tolerate. At a point in my life, I had a friend who used to tell me that he didn't think that I had friends, I had a caseload. That other-centeredness that results in the abandonment of self, almost willing to give up ourselves. Communication problems, intimacy problems, and sort of the ongoing whirlwind that through the five stages of grief that happen. The denial, the anger, the shock, the depression, and then maybe finally the acceptance. Another view of codependency is by somebody in Minnesota by the name of Ernie Larson, who talks about it in terms of roles he sees. Caretakers, people pleasers, workaholics, martyrs, perfectionists, tap dancers. All of those are seen as really self-defeating behaviors in an effort to control another person. More recently, a popular book that's been on the bestseller list for a long time is written by a woman by the name of Robin Norwood called Women Who Love Too Much. Mm-hmm. Although the title, you know, is kind of catchy, I think she talks about in the beginning that it also describes a phenomenon that's not, that men are not immune to either. Although the title is Women Who Love Too Much and When You Keep Wishing and Hoping He'll Change. And obviously, people must relate to it because the book has been selling, you know, like wildfire. And I think she does really have some good points to make in the book about the whole phenomenon of codependency. Another question that arises, and well, is it an illness? We talk about alcoholism or chemical dependency being an illness. And one person has gone to great lengths to talk about it in the form that we use in the helping profession, a manual called the Diagnostic Manual for, what is the DSM it's called, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual used for diagnosing emotional problems. And Tim Cermak, in his book, Codependency, Diagnosing and Treating, A Guide for Professionals, the significant things that he considers in a diagnosis are these. Actually talks about five things. And the first one is continued investment of self-esteem in the ability to control both oneself and others in the face of serious adverse consequences. A significant part of that is in the face of serious adverse consequences. In other words, going to great lengths and yourself paying a price to do that. The second one that he lists as part of the diagnostic criteria is the assumption of responsibility for meeting others' needs to the exclusion of acknowledging one's own. In other words, my needs don't count at all. A third one that he lists is anxiety and boundary distortions around intimacy and separation. Inability to kind of set a boundary of this is where I end and this is where the other person begins, and getting that really confused. A fourth one is enmeshment in relationships with personality disordered, chemically dependent, other codependent, and or impulse disordered individuals. enmeshment in relationships with personality disordered, chemically dependent, other codependent, and or impulse disordered individuals. Enmeshment, again. Inability to kind of separate oneself. And then the fifth one, he says, is three or more of the following. And then he lists 10 of them. Three or more of the following. One is excessive reliance on denial. And I'll talk more about that characteristic in a while. Constriction of emotions. We often say codependent people are emotionally constipated. They're unable to express their emotions. Or if they do, it's with these dramatic outbursts.
Boom.
Yeah, pretty dramatic. The third one is depression. You can imagine, we say depression literally is that it's depressing emotions. A person is bound to get depressed if they're, you know, holding all that in. Hypervigilance, you know, just willing to do everything exactly by the letter to the T and being hypervigilant about their activities and work. Compulsions. Sixth one is anxiety. The seventh one is substance abuse. The eighth one is has been or is the victim of recurrent physical or sexual abuse. The ninth one is stress-related medical illnesses. And the tenth one is has remained in a primary relationship with an active substance abuser for at least 2 years without seeking outside help. Has remained in a primary relationship with an active substance abuser for at least 2 years without seeking outside help. That's the diagnostic criteria that is hopefully going to be entered in the next DSM manual. And that would be the criteria that they would use to diagnose it, which it also would make it treatable and a diagnosis that would lend itself to being covered by insurance. Well, that's kind of heavy. I think, I don't know about you, but the reaction I often have when I talk to people, especially in the church kind of business, is that really ever since people have existed, we have been doing all the things that we label codependent, right? We've worried ourselves sick about other people. We've tried to help in ways that didn't help. We've said yes when we meant no. We make others see things our way. We might have bent over backward to avoid hurting people's feelings and hurting themselves. I describe.
Are you saying the church is codependent on sin?
Oh, that's a whole nother forum or discussion session, I think. But when we talk about that bending over backwards phenomenon, I sometimes say that codependents are the people who apologize for bumping into a coffee table. You know, they're the ones that are always saying, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." Afraid to trust our own feelings, believing lies and then feel betrayed, felt so angry that we wanted to kill. Codependents maybe have been struggled for their rights while others said they didn't have any. They're the people who might have worn sackcloth because they didn't believe they deserved silk. Well, undoubtedly now, codependents have done good deeds too, right? By nature, codependents are benevolent and concerned about and responsive to the needs of the world, right? So are all helpers codependent? Becomes a good question. And when does our helping become codependent? There's one well-known author who says, "I suspect that codependents have historically attacked social injustice and fought for the rights of the underdog. Codependents want to help. I suspect they have helped, but they probably died thinking they didn't do enough and were feeling guilty." I think it's natural to want to protect and help the people we care about. And it's also natural to be affected by and react to the problems that people are having around us. As the problem becomes more serious and remains unresolved, we usually become more affected and react more intensely to it. But I think that that's really one of the keys, is that codependency is a reactionary process. Because codependents don't act, they only react. They don't feel like they have a choice to act. And rarely do they act. It's also been described as an illness because we see a progressive quality to it. It seems to worsen as people continue to have it. It seems like they never get better kind of by themselves. And it seems that often it requires a real painful kind of experience before they're willing to kind of have some awareness about the process going on for them. And so in that, it has the qualities of a disease in the fact that it's progressive. Before I list the things that and the qualities and characteristics of codependence and what they tend to do, I want to make a really important point. And that is that having these problems does not mean that we're necessarily bad, defective, or inferior in any kind of way. It means that we maybe learned these things as children, or we maybe learned them later in life, or we might have even learned them from our own interpretation of religion. And we might have learned them as being desirable feminine traits. That's what good women do. We probably did them out of a need to protect ourselves and to meet our own needs, or maybe even just to survive. But they might have outgrown their usefulness, or they might have become painful, or they might have produced some really harmful consequences in our life to the point that we kind of become awake or awoken or whatever to what was happening. As somebody says, codependency is a way of getting needs met that doesn't get needs met, if that makes any sense. Codependency is a way of getting needs met that doesn't get needs met. Or maybe we've been doing the wrong things for the right reasons. We've been doing the wrong things for the right reasons. So what are the characteristics of codependency then? What are some of the things that we see? I'm going to talk about 17 of them. And if you were at the lecture yesterday, you heard these first few because I talked about chemical dependency families and everybody having them. And the first one was denial. Denial or delusion. And that's, in effect, living under a lot of stress and saying, I'm okay. You know, sometimes when codependent people will talk about what's happened to them, it's amazing to me that they're even still alive. Because they begin to, you know, as an alcoholic grows tolerance for the chemical alcohol or a sedative or whatever, physiologically, codependents develop an incredible amount of tolerance of a lot of stress. They're able to tolerate things that, you know, healthier people, so to speak, or people who have a sense of what is tolerable, and believe that they're not affected in that process. The denial is often mistakenly linked with maturity. Like, as a grown-up, I should be able to handle all of this. Or they maybe spend a lot of time buying all kinds of self-help books with the belief that knowledge is what heals hurts and hearts. And it's not always bad. It helps us to survive reading those books. But there's a denial and a delusion of the fact that they've even been affected by tolerating all of that stress. So denial and delusion is one. Second one, as I talked about yesterday, is compulsion. And that's the have to, that sort of drive, I have to. Feeling that there's no choice, that survival role becomes entrenched to the detriment of the person's life. Third one is frozen feelings. And that again, like yesterday I talked about, when the expression of feelings is seen as a threat. Codependent people get really uncomfortable when people really talk about their real feelings. Or they feel like they have to jump in and fix them or medicate them more or make it all better. And the people have a really hard time just letting people maybe express their feelings and not have to do anything about them or fix them. Or they're out of touch with their own feelings, out of touch with their own pain and their own guilt, and they're dishonest with themselves about that. The fourth one is low self-worth. In the course of living with chronic depression, I believe my mother developed a lot of codependency traits. And she's made lots of awareness of that in some ways and in other ways not. But we often tell the story in our family of how my mom was always willing to sort of make all these other meals for all of us, and she'd sit at the corner of the table on a stool, not have a chair, not have a whole table place, and say, "It's okay, I'm just going to eat this cheese sandwich." Mm-hmm. Kind of like total denial of herself having anything. It's okay, I'll just sit over here in this corner and have this cheese sandwich while we all have a feast of some kind. That low self-worth, being willing to give up, I don't deserve to have more than a cheese sandwich, so to speak. And accepting a lot of the blame and the responsibility in a no-win situation, it becomes almost a setup for failure. And then the fifth one was medical complications or health problems as a result. You can imagine the stress that this can take on a person's body if they're tolerating that all of the time. That might take the form of chronic fatigue, migraines, backaches, high blood pressure, stress-related illnesses, ulcers, asthma. Insurance studies have found that the benefits are most used by family members of chemical dependency over the chemically dependent person, which is sort of ironic because a lot of times insurance companies are concerned about insuring alcoholics because it's such a chronic, repeating disease, and yet really it's the family members often that have the higher use of the benefits. A sixth one is the inability to have spontaneous fun or to let go. A feeling that they need to be serious. Life is serious. And spontaneity can't be trusted. You have to know what's going to happen all the time. Plan, plan, plan. Has to be all organized. And a need to control self and others. And the more out of control one feels, the more tightly they'll try to hang on. Even more. Seventh one is depression. Or anger. The denial of anger. The fear of accepting feelings. Like I said, depression is literally depressing one's feelings. And so a lot of times what depression really is a person's not allowed themselves to really emote or express their feelings. And there's a tremendous fear of being unable to handle it. If I let out all my rage, what would possibly happen to me? I might do something awful. And so there's a tremendous fear of that. I'm going to erase here. An eighth one is a lot of anxiety about and confusion about making decisions. A afraid of being wrong. If I make a decision, will it be the wrong one? Sometimes not wanting to miss out on anything, and so they stay ambivalent for a long period of time. And just a lot of fear that a decision or a change actually also changes might be wrong. Sometimes it's sort of like thinking that life is a dress rehearsal. And like, when I get to this point, kind of thinking. A ninth one is problems with intimacy. If a person is so controlled all the time and has all this, you know, organization around them, it becomes very difficult for people to get very close to that person. Trusting another often for this kind of person has led to a lot of disappointment and betrayal. And so why should I trust? And consequently, they might avoid wanting to, repeat that pain again. And so rather than trust at all, they just maintain a real distance and a wall up. And perhaps the problem is really in asking to be intimate with someone who's not able to be. That might be more the problem. Tenth one is lies and exaggerates when it would be easier to tell the truth. Sort of like I said yesterday, codependents often have a really nice smile on their face, and I'm okay, it's all right, I'm not hurting, everything's okay in our family, and they have this kind of smile across their face. They often, in that process, I think, is where the spiritual consequence of the disease really lies, in that they find honesty a very difficult kind of thing to do or to experience. And I think in that process, they may compromise their own values and experience a loss of spirituality. And when I talk about spirituality, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking more about their view of life and their own creative self. So the denial or inability to be really honest with people is a real sacrifice to themselves. They also have a tremendous fear of losing themselves. In the process of being obsessed with another person, one doesn't really have time to develop oneself, right? It's almost like, you're obsessed this whole time on this other person, you begin to not even know really who you are because you spend all this time being involved in what's happening to another person. It's kind of like I said, vicariously living your life through another person. 12th one is the tendency to look for people to take care of. Or a gravitation towards needy people. Well, I believe that, many people come into the helping profession with very good motives, and I think more and more a lot of the education of people in preparation for different helping professions are really challenging people in that process to look at their motives in wanting to go into a counseling kind of role with people, having them examine a lot of their own family issues to see if it's not breeded or coming from the dynamics of being in that family. Because in looking for people to take care of, that's necessary in order to feel needed, valued, and good about oneself. That's where a lot of a person's self-worth comes from. Let me help you. And it's wonderful to be needed by others, right? I think that's a quality we see often in the church and often in places like Holy Village. And once again, I'm not being critical of that quality. It's just when it pays a price on the people involved. The 13th one is the inability to know what normal is. It's a sense of sort of not knowing. What normal is. Kind of guessing all of the time. The way I feel, I wonder if I'm going crazy. Sometimes people will come in for counseling and they'll describe everything that's gone on and they don't even think that maybe, well, that's, doesn't everybody experience that? Isn't that the normal life for everybody? You know, shouldn't I be, isn't that normal? And there's a real sense of not knowing, you know, what's normal in terms of taking care of themselves or living their life, and they should be tolerating all of that. Another one is anxiety about making changes. And that's very threatening. I don't think I could handle it if I got that promotion. Being real content to maybe just stay exactly where they are, because to have to, you know, move into another thing is very scary. And so they become very comfortable in that position, which is also another reason that why they stay in the relationship with somebody for years, because of the fear that the change maybe brings. Another one is, it's black and white kind of thinking or judgments. Everything is either good or bad, right or wrong, perfect or imperfect, black or white, and there's no room for compromise. It's a sort of an either-or mentality. Can't tolerate any gray areas. Can't be unknowing. Can't be maybe suspended for a while. Everything has to be very concrete and black and white. And no room for compromise. The 16th one is fear of abandonment. So often people will say, when they look at a codependent in a particular kind of relationship, why do they stay with that person? Why don't they just get out? Why don't, you know, they just hang it up? And that's very simple to do. But there's a tremendous fear of really being abandoned, being left. I'm no clinging vine, but I couldn't live without you. Kind of the thinking. And then finally the last one is the need to control. Self or others. Oftentimes these people get described as real controllers. It's hard to be around them. I can't let my guard down. Life is a very serious business. And I have to have everything under control. And there's a tremendous fear, you know, in doing that. The big areas for codependency then lie in the caretaking phenomena, the low self-worth, the repression of feelings, the obsession, the controlling, the denial, the dependency, the poor communication, the weak boundary areas. A lot of times people will say, well, I would never put up with that, but that person would. Tolerating. And that's one of the reasons I said yesterday that oftentimes employers like to hire codependents because they will work endlessly, you know. More than, you know, they'll do the work of two people. They keep letting people hurt them, and they'll tolerate certain behaviors from other people that maybe the rest of us wouldn't. Then they might finally blow up, he said. The lack of trust is another phenomenon. The anger. And those are really the important areas. What I'm going to do is leave a copy of a test that people can take. It's 60 questions, and the scoring will be listed at the end of it, so that you can take a codependency test if you want. I'll leave it in the library, just to get an idea of what your own level of codependency is. And I think it's important to not look at it as black and white, as either you are or you aren't, or like being kind of pregnant, but to be willing to maybe look at certain times or places or relationships in your life, and maybe you relate to some of these more than others. Maybe you focus your attention on pleasing others. Maybe you're the kind of person who ignores your personal interests and your needs in favors of others. Maybe you base your response to others on your fear of rejection or anger. Maybe you focus on getting others to do things your way. Maybe you place other values second to yours. Maybe you base your self-image on what others think and say about you. Maybe you deny your truth or cover up the truth in order to save yourself from some pain or hurt. Maybe you deny reality by the kind of thinking, well, things will change when something happens. Well, what are things and what is something? And maybe you wait a long time for that to happen. Maybe you're the kind of person who's out of touch with your feelings and not knowing what you're feeling or how to communicate that. Another quality of codependency is having a really high need or addiction to physical sensations, be that taste or running or some kind of activity. Or maybe you've suffered physical illness from how much you've been willing to tolerate in your own life. I want to close with a poem, and then we'll open it up for questions. Because I won't talk a lot about recovery, I'll just end with this poem, and maybe you'll have some thoughts about that. After a while, you learn the subtle difference between holding a hand and chaining a soul. And you learn that love doesn't mean leaning, and company doesn't mean security. And you begin to learn that kisses aren't contracts, and presents aren't promises. And you begin to accept your defeats with your head up and your eyes open, with the grace of an adult, not the grief of a child. And you learn to build all your roads on today, because tomorrow's ground is too uncertain for plans. After a while, you learn that even sunshine burns if you get too much. So plant your own garden and decorate your own soul instead of waiting for someone to bring you flowers. And you learn that you really can endure, that you really are strong, and you really do have worth. Okay. Any questions, comments?
Can you say something about recovery, Jackie?
Yeah, once we take the test, what's the next step?
Well, know the answer to the test.
Yeah. I'd really like a whole other session to do that, but I think if codependency is happening in a relationship with somebody who is alcoholic or chemically dependent, I think one of the best places to start is to attend a self-help group called Al-Anon, which is for parents or family or friends of somebody who has an alcohol or chemical problem. And Al-Anon is listed in the yellow pages in most phone books. And it really is the synonymous kind, or the analogous self-help program as Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who are alcoholic. I think Al-Anon is a self-help 12-step program for people who struggle with the whole issue of codependency. And I think that's a real good place to start if you don't have any money, and even if you do have money, to get counseling. That's a totally self-help, non-professional kind of group. And I think people who just work in the helping profession can benefit a great deal from Al-Anon, because it's a wonderful way to learn how to let go and not be in control. And that's kind of the first place, I think. I think there are some good self-help books that I'm happy to share with people that I think have good activities and are workbooks, more or less, for people who want to look at the issue. I think seeking out counselors or therapists who have experience working with it is also another good way to start. In many cities, as I understand it, there are groups that have started around the book Women Who Love Too Much. And in the back of her book, she talks about how to organize a group, how to use affirmations, self-affirmations, for working on yourself. And she also has some other recommended reading in the back here. And, you know, I think if you're dealing with particular other kinds of programs or problems like compulsive eating, I believe Overeaters Anonymous is also another good self-help group. There also is Naranon, which is like Al-Anon for people who are related to somebody who has a narcotic addiction or an addiction other than alcohol to any kind of other chemical. I think the recovery process is one of really focusing all of your attention in some ways on yourself and being willing to really discover yourself, not in the relationship of somebody else, be that your family or partner.
Do you feel that as an ongoing thing? You know, you don't all of a sudden just, you know, you go through a process and you're cured, or is it an ingrained way of life that you have to constantly be aware of the little things that you do all the time that might have codependency characteristics?
Well, I think it kind of depends. There are a lot of people that would argue and say that it's chronic. You know, it will always be present. And I think it kind of depends on whether how strong those family rules were influenced you, how much you're able to kind of double-check your own behaviors, or how much you need sort of the contact with other people who sort of challenge you on that. I think the potential probably is always there, the tendency, perhaps. Learning how to take care of yourself by, you know, retreating and renewing and really finding the things in life that are life-giving to you, I think is really important. Yeah.
Just out of curiosity, of the 17 points, is there anybody in here that doesn't identify with at least some of those? In terms of, I'm looking at this one now, inability to know what normal is, I think. Is there anybody that doesn't identify with it?
Let you know what normal is.
Well,
I
really understand what you're saying. I think the really unique part of that is that there's just a pervading feeling sometimes for people to just not really know or think everybody else read the book on life, and why was I not given a copy of it? And that's sort of it's a real strong pervasive feeling that they don't really know what normal is. I'm not talking about, well, that's just who I am kind of thing, but it's a real pervasive.
But going through that, you see, I see a couple of those things. I see myself there.
Sure.
Others not at all. But
yeah.
I kind of think, is that a normal position? Any of you that are 100% free?
If you are, see Carol later.
Yeah, see me.
Jackie?
Yeah.
When you're I don't know how to ask this because I think I know that there isn't an answer. But in most cases where people are dealing not with alcohol or substance abuse, but have just learned how to relate in this kind of dysfunctional way, what can most people recover without severing the relationship in which they are codependent? Or for most people, is severing that relationship a necessary part of recovery?
Anybody else want to respond?
I think that's how much we're trying
to do. Well, my wife said it was severing. But no, the codependency essentially is that she went to where the thing that finally made her decide on her divorce. However, she has not been able to come to the point where she can make the decision of the divorce. Mm-hmm. I mean, it fit there, but I think maybe the both of us are codependent.
Sure. What were you going to say, Sam?
I think that a severing of the relationship isn't necessary, because as long as the codependent recognizes that this is a problem and is willing to go through a lot of letting go, and if the sometimes it's more of a result that relationship breaks just because the two parties can't handle the change. I mean, there's a lot of change that needs to be made, and so it just kind of results in a severing. But that's just from my experience. Mm-hmm. It doesn't necessarily call for it.
Certainly, it can be tougher. I think it kind of depends on how chronic the relationship has gotten. I mean, how long it's really been in that pattern. I think a lot of people can change within a relationship, definitely, and their change does not depend on the other person changing. That's the whole notion, of course. But I think one of the problems is that when you're, like you said, Sarah, it upsets the whole dynamic of the relationship, and unless the other person is in some way willing to kind of look at their own participation in that, it's very upsetting. And usually what happens is, if not a physical divorce, an emotional one certainly does happen. And that's, you know, immediately codependents will often ask, they'll say, "Well, are you telling me I should divorce him?" You know, and almost want somebody else to make that decision for them. And I've seen many people recover within a relationship and their relationship change. Other people have to treat it almost like a drug, alcohol, and like totally abstain, because it's just too, the continued exposure just activates the whole phenomenon, the whole behavior.
Somebody said earlier a line about the church being codependent on sin. What I've been sitting here thinking is, I think most pastors and congregations are codependent. I look at my own case, and I look at how my congregation related to my predecessor, and I look at the ways in which I want to change, and it's just interesting to wonder how the congregation will react to that. And mm-hmm. I think if I leave, they'll find someone else to be codependent on, mm-hmm. because I think at least most of the congregations I've had experience with, want a codependent sort of person mm-hmm. to do all the caregiving. Mm-hmm. And then all the caretaking.
Yeah.
I think that there's a grain of the kind of personality that you see in a codependent person. There's a lot of compassion and a lot of caring, and a lot of that is in sync with what we learn as Christians, as the type of people to be. So I get real confused sometimes looking at myself and saying, is this codependent behavior, or is this Christian behavior, or is there a difference, mm-hmm. or where's the healthiness in it?
Mm-hmm. I think the fact that you're even asking the question, though, is a good sign. Because it's a real self-care issue in some ways. It's being willing to take care of yourself so that you can be the giving person.
So you can still take care of people if you take care of yourself first.
Yeah. And I don't want to get into the whole notion of, well, is codependency sort of the 1980s way of being so focused on me, me, me?
Yeah.
I don't mean to imply that. Somebody else, you.
I've always heard this in terms of alcoholism, but it's striking me that one's response and could slip into that with handicapped or mentally,
definitely.
You know, children that are chronic mm-hmm. type situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I shared yesterday that one of the guidelines I use for myself is the whole question of, am I working harder at a problem that belongs to somebody else than they are? And, you know, if that is the case, then I need to step back, because then I'm not allowing them to experience the consequences of that problem that will force and motivate and thrust them into a solution or a change. And I'm actually depriving them in some ways.
one thing I've found, because I've been involved not only in my family, but other dysfunctional families where there's dying and death going on, it just gets crazier and crazier as the person dies and my codependency with my mother just dying in May, you know, I couldn't sever a codependent relationship while she was dying, but I really had to. It took a lot of effort for me to stay healthy during that process, and I didn't always. I mean, I reverted back to a lot of mm-hmm. things, and after she died, then I had to deal with them. But it gets real mm-hmm. tough when it's a parent or a child or somebody. You just don't sever the relationship. You gotta. Mm-hmm. But it's hard.
Yeah. Don't forget the guilt killing.
Sure.
Okay, so I should do that.
Sure.
That, or is it my fault or
mm-hmm.
no, it's guilt.
Mm-hmm. And that guilt is related a lot, Carol, to what you said about not knowing what's normal. You know, oh my gosh, I should do that. That's a real struggle.
Well, the term dysfunctional comes up and it just doesn't mean anything to me. Okay. I mean, I kind of fill it in, but not too well, other than it isn't Leave It to Beaver or
uh-huh.
family
uh-huh.
or Body Does Best or something.
Are you saying you want a definition
yeah,
of a dysfunctional family?
Yeah, without getting whole session out of it.
Well, yeah, like, I think it's important to look at it on a continuum and not say, this is a dysfunctional family and this is a functional one. But to really see sort of functionalism in a family as kind of a continuum that goes from very severely dysfunctional to having maybe other qualities that are healthier. And I talked a little, when I talked about some of the rules that were on in the family, actually kind of reversed those in some ways. And I think those are more the dynamics of a healthier family, such as direct communication, ability to be different, or freedom to change, open expression of feelings. Growth is used in the is the result from discipline and not punishment. Discipline is used as a growth process, not as a punitive kind of thing. There's feedback. People get feedback about their behavior. They don't go to somebody else about it. It's okay to kind of go outside the family. People can come in and go out of the family. It's not a closed kind of system. You're not told to not talk about things. In other words, don't air anything outside of the family. It's okay. There's no secrets. People know the rules. They know the rules. They're not changing all the time. Okay, thank you very much.